So David's absconded over to Hawaii, and he asked me, well, Doug, couldn't you give a message next Sunday? And I thought, oh, sure, I could give a message. So I think that was after he asked Bill Cooper. Well, Bill Cooper is in heaven. Then he asked Chuck Missler. Well, Chuck Missler's in heaven. Henry Morris, he's in heaven. The only guy that's around that I think is would be a superb speaker for this would be Walt Brown. And he's 85 years old. He's in Phoenix. So usually I announce that I'm the second string announcement giver. Well, I'm actually 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth announcement, fifth string announcement speaker today, or at least giving the message. Chose Genesis 1 through 11 to go through. This is an overview at about 30,000 feet, 40,000 feet. Hopefully we can actually get through this without me having any apoplexy. So when I was in, the reason I'm wearing white Lycos is this. There was a study done at Stanford University. There was a guy with a light white lab coat, and then there was a box that would give out an electrical charge. And then they would have someone, anyone, sit there. And then there was another person in another room. And the person that was at the electrical charge box could see them and hear them. And then the guy with the white lab coat would tell the person to give the person in the other room an electrical charge. Well, on the box itself, it had, this is a lot of electricity. This is a whole bunch of electricity. This is lethal dose electricity. So what was found in the study, it wasn't the person in the other room that was getting the testing done. It was actually the person that was sitting at the electrical charge box. And what was found was that 2/3 of the people that sat down there, as long as the person with the white lab coat was giving the orders, they would follow directions, and they would just keep cranking up the dose of electricity until this guy in the next room, of course, was screaming at the top of his lungs. The take-home message is, I wanted to have a sense of authority today. I figured I would wear the white lab coat. And we pulled this deal when we went to Sacramento, because all of the doctors that went there to testify about vaccines and how potentially hazardous they are, everybody wore white lab coats. The other problem was there were a whole bunch of other doctors who wore white lab coats too. Anyway, I'm done with my white lab coat. I'm done. Okay. So, quiz question. Who wrote Genesis? So there are actually three right answers on that. One is God. That's a right answer. Second one would be Moses. That's a right answer. The third one, which actually hones things down a little bit, is there were at least 11 different authors in the entire book of Genesis. I'm focusing on Genesis 1 through 11. So I want to run through the different authors, the various authors that are in the book of Genesis, because it's kind of important. And I think it'll kind of bring, you should hear screeching breaks when you hear this, or at least if you understand what I'm trying to tell you. Who would have been able to see what happened in creation? God would have been the only one that was there that could actually tell you what had happened. So the only eyewitness to creation was God. In the actual text itself, there is essentially something called a sincerely yours. In Hebrew, it's called a toledoth. They found it in the Babylonian first. But what a toledoth is a sincerely yours. It just tells you who was the writer. In Genesis 2:4, it's a sincerely yours or a toledoth. God wrote the first two chapters up to verse 4 of the second chapter. After that, who could have told you what happened to Adam and Eve? Adam did, actually. It was Adam. He was squealing on his wife, right? So, and that actually stops. That toledoth actually stops at about 5 verse 1. It's this is the genealogy, or this is the history of. There are other places. Who could have told you about the flood of Noah? Noah actually helped write the book of Genesis. Then you find Shem, Ham, and Japheth were co-authors. And then you find that Shem was a co-author. And then going along, you find that Terah was a co-author. He was the father of Abram. And you find that Abram was a co-author. What it does in my mind is like, holy cow, these are eyewitness accounts of all this stuff that's going on. So where does that play out? For me, it gives me an immediacy of the book of Genesis that I'd just never seen before. We're looking at an actual eyewitness account of exactly what happened in the entire creation of God. In Genesis 1 through 11, we're really speaking in a certain way about a secular history, because the first Jew really started with Abraham. And so it tails into the very end of Genesis 11, but we're really looking at a secular history in regards to what all the peoples of the world should have seen. So when you're looking at all the peoples of the world, you should notice that there are ancient tales that all tie back to Genesis 1 through 11. The big things in this book that everybody, or at least the people that keep their traditions, should have gone back to is you should see some type of universal flood. You should see some type of universal fall from grace. You should see some type of creation, of course. But also you should see a dissemination of the nation. So I'm going to try and cover a few of those things as we go along. If this were really true, and by the way, I have every suspicion that it is, I stole that Toledoff deal from Henry Morris. He wrote a book called The Genesis Record. And since he's in heaven right now, I don't think he's going to complain. Bill Cooper is a guy who wrote the authenticity of the New Testament. So we've got an Old Testament, which is, you know, the start is right here. We've got the New Testament, which is the new agreement that God made with us. Bill Cooper did a great job. Has anybody heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Have you all heard that there were New Testament books found in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Good. I didn't think anybody had. In Cave 7, there were actually four different versions of the Gospel of Mark found in there. There was also a commentary on the book of Romans. So the Dead Sea Scrolls were all packed in caves, and they were sealed over because everybody started realizing, oh my gosh, the Romans are coming. We're going to lose all our data and all our sacred scriptures. There was a commentary on the book of Romans found in Cave 7 that was unique in all of the history of ancient papyrology, and that was actually, it was a reverse piece of the book of, a commentary on the book of Romans, because it looked like it had been stuck to ground, and it was a reversed picture of what a commentary in the book of Romans was. So our best guess in regards to the book of Romans is it was written in about 63 AD. So that book that was a commentary on the book of Romans would have been sealed in about 68 AD, and what that indicates is that there was an extraordinary dissemination of this information in regards to the Gospels, in regards to the various letters that Paul had written. But it just kind of brings you up, and you keep hearing this brake screeching because you realize, oh my gosh, we're right where almost the eyewitnesses are there. When you're reading this book, you're reading eyewitness accounts. That's what I want to bring to you guys. And that's why it's so fascinating to me to actually see it. So anyway, but a book of Mark, four different versions. What do I mean by versions? There were things called scriptorums. We didn't have a Kinko's. We didn't have a FedEx. We didn't have, who is it? Who else sends stuff out? Parcel Post. Anybody that copies things? We didn't have those back in the olden days in the first century AD. But what they did have was they'd have scriptorums. And every one of the scriptorums had their own particular idiosyncrasies in the way they made letters, and you literally find four different scriptoriums had put together portions of the book of Mark. That's why we know that there were at least four books of Mark in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Why is that important? because that, so those were most likely not the originals, but what it does do is it brings you all the way back to the idea that, oh my gosh, if this is just a copy, that's not even a generation from the actual signatures of what's going on. That's wild stuff. So when you're reading the Bible, God seems to have a real, I put it this way because it makes so much sense to me. God has this character flaw. He has several character flaws, but what is his big character flaw? He can't lie. So in order to illustrate that, I have to go back to my medical training. I should probably put my white lab coat on again. But when I have a kid that comes in and he's got a huge amount of eczema and it all started when he started eating first foods, I tell the moms, you know, there are three things that are the most likely things that are here. The first one is somehow your baby got exposed to dairy. And the moms nod their heads, yes. By the way, after you do this, you can be medical doctors. This will be great, right? Yeah. And then I said, the second one is you probably haven't heard of it, it's called dairy. So, and then, of course, the third thing here is dairy is the most likely cause, number three cause of eczema in these kids. So anyway, in regards to God's character flaw, the first thing is God can't tell a lie. The second one is, it's very similar to it, but you'll probably notice that there's a recurrent theme here, that is God can't lie. He's just got this enormous weight on his shoulders that he just can't lie. Third one is very similar to it. You may notice there's a continuing trend here. God just can't lie. In fact, in Titus 1:2, it says, "And God who cannot lie." So, when we're reading the Bible, guess what? We're actually reading truth. Whoa. So, so I wanted to make sure that everybody understands that what we're reading in Genesis 1 through 11 is kind of unique in this sense. Everything after Genesis 11 is much more related to the people of Israel. Genesis 1 through 11, you keep finding that trend of all people should have some kind of texture as to what's gone on before them. Why is Genesis 1 through 11 important, or what good is it? So I've gotten an illustration for you. By the way, I'm traveling with a handicap. You know, English is apparently my first language, but you won't be able to notice that. But when a doctor gives a talk, usually they have Gary Larson cartoons. And you'll notice that is not a Gary Larson cartoon. So I'm just having to work with no illustrations for you. So I had to make kind of a mind illustration for you guys. Depending on where you start will tell you where you're going to end up. Example. So I'm going to take two cities in the state of California, and I'm going to do the same thing in each city. I'm going to go east for 2,000 miles from Los Angeles. Where am I going to end up? I don't know, maybe Virginia Beach. I'm going to do 2,000 miles from San Francisco. Where am I going to end up? I'm not going to end up in the same place. We have to start from the right beginnings. We have to start from the right beginnings, or what's going to happen, depending on your starting point, is you're going to be all screwed up. You're not going to get to where you want to be. That's why this, in my view, although it's only 11 chapters, it's exquisitely important for our understanding of where we want to head. You've already gotten my main point, God can't lie. So everything else is just a freebie today. But we've got to start from the right beginning. There really are only two major philosophies in the world today. You can split them up into two places. One is, I am a created being by the Creator himself. That's one philosophy. The other one is, I am being and I'm becoming, which is the philosophy of an evolutionary mindset. So in order to get that, this is a huge dividing line. Genesis 1 through 11 is a huge dividing line because some of you actually remember this. It starts like, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and the earth was covered. The earth was covered by all the waters. The beginning point. All you really need to remember in regards to the Bible is if you can remember and believe the first four words, you're home free. In the beginning, God. So, just saying. So why did I get so interested in Genesis 1 through 11? I need to read this because it really illustrates my problem. And I'll try and relate it to you guys. So it's actually in Genesis 3:12. It says, the man said, the woman whom thou gave with me, she gave me of the tree, and I ate. So there's a little blame game going on there. So to explain why I had to read that to you guys. So we were living in Pasadena, and we were going to a little Methodist church, and the pastor had mentioned in the sermon, and then God used evolution to make us what we are today. And we, Gloria and I'm not supposed to use names, but Gloria and I were sitting in the pew, and we're like, okay, all right. So when we walked out, can I use your name? Will it be all right? Okay, so Gloria turns to me, and she says, honey, do you think God could have used evolution to make us what we are today? And I'm like, well, honey, you know, God is really big. He's gigantic. So God could have used evolution to make us what we are today. And she turned to me and she said, you know, that is the stupidest thing I have ever heard you say in your entire life. And, you know, first impression for me was, you know, I'd worked up to this. I had glasses by then. I even had a beard so I could stroke my beard and look intelligent, you know. And I was in Pasadena. Pasadena is the home of Caltech. You know, that's the home of Richard Feynman, considered by some people as the world's smartest man. A guy named Albert Einstein, some of you have heard of him, you know. And then Linus Pauling. Every one of those guys were Nobel Prize winners. Just the creme de la creme of the crop of hyper-intellect. And here I'm being questioned about my understanding of how the cosmology of the universe is. So I thought, well, you know, honey, you know, I'm really smart. I'm a doctor. I'm with Kaiser. And God is big enough to use evolution. And, you know, I'd taken a class on genetics and evolution at Oral Roberts University. I got an A in the class. And gosh, I can't believe you'd say that. So that sent me on a quest. So now I've read about 150 books on the subject of evolution creation. And after, you know, a few years, I finally came to the conclusion that the stupidest thing I've ever said in my entire existence was the idea that God used evolution to make us what we are today. We actually had started a Bible science group up in Aberdeen, and so we actually gave different talks on different aspects of God's creation. But so I can always blame the woman who God gave me. So,
that's funny.
Well, it wasn't very funny to me, I'll tell you. So, big question. So I'm trying to answer who, what, where, when, how, why in this little talk. Where did the Garden of Eden happen? Any clues? I would say that it's absolutely impossible to figure out where the Garden of Eden actually was. There's a scripture in 1 Peter that says, the world that then was destroyed. Now, there's some places on the planet that have at least 5,000 feet of sediments on them. So to find the Garden of Eden at this point in our existence would be just about impossible. That's interesting, because when I read other Bible commentaries, they say, oh, it was Mesopotamia. It's like, how do they know that? As you're reading the actual description of the Garden of Eden, there are actually four rivers that are coming out of Eden. And there are no places on this planet that would indicate that there are four rivers like that. There are two rivers that we know of. There's Tigris, Euphrates. But realize people have a trend and a tendency when they move to a new place to call the places what they were in the olden times. Examples, has anyone heard of New York? Well, there's a place called York in England, so they call it New York. There's the Hebrides Islands. There's also a New Hebrides. I'm sure there's a Jersey, because there's a New Jersey. So all of these places got named because of their, I guess they just decided, well, we have to name it something, and that's a part of what we'll do. So my vote is we'll never find where the Garden of Eden actually was. And it's covered by igneous rock, sedimentary rock, metamorphic rock. We got all that stuff. Has anybody here ever driven on the road in Highway 68 where the road cuts are? How about the one south where the road cuts are, where you see the limestone? Nobody here drive? You two are the only two that drive. Okay, that's good. So when you're driving by there, nobody else here is driving. I'm watching you guys. You're going to see the road cuts with the limestone. You see these multitudinous layers of limestone there. The only way those could have come about from a geologic standpoint is if there was at least a continent-wide flood, and I would submit to you that it was more likely a worldwide flood, just like the one that's mentioned in the Bible. Those extraordinary straight layers that you see can only have been laid down by a liquefaction event, and that only occurs under massive amounts of water, like you may have heard, like Noah's flood. We find those layers, has anybody here, now that we only know that there are two people here that drive, has anybody ever gone to the Grand Canyon? I see those hands. They're rising up all over the auditorium. So if you look out over the horizon, miles and miles across, you see these massive pieces of sedimentary rock that literally could only have been laid down by a continent-wide, at least, flooding that it would occur because of this phenomenon called liquefaction. Liquefaction is very important in San Francisco because it's a shuttling event that happens in earthquakes, but it also happens underwater. And you guys have all experienced it, you just didn't realize it. When you're walking on the seashore, you're actually experiencing liquefaction. That only occurs on a massive scale, like, say, Noah's flood. I would guess, this isn't a guess, it's actually real. There are 500 different flood stories across the world, both northern, southern, eastern, western hemispheres, all talking about worldwide flood. Almost as if it had occurred. In my mind, the question that keeps arising is, well, if this record is true, I'm already telling you this is an eyewitness record. What should we be finding in the geology? What should we be finding in the stories that are coming down to us from our progenitors or from our the people that we've been hanging out with? I believe the only thing that lines up correctly is the idea that God actually... Remember what the one thing I was trying to make sure you guys remembered was that God can't lie? God still can't lie. But the only thing that makes sense when you're looking at the geology is that there literally was a worldwide flood. Post-flood, I just mentioned that there, post-flood in Genesis, I think 9, 10, and 11, there are place names that we can still find, but the flood did a pretty good job of obliterating an entire world. The reason I think we need to look at Noah's flood is because Jesus, of course, said, as in the days of Noah, men will be marrying and giving in marriage, but the same amount of sin apparently is going to be going on then as was there. There's one place, let's see, who knows where this will lead us, because I wrote all these out and I must have been in a blur of sleepiness. But I'll just mention it. It's mentioned in two places. One is in actually the genealogy of some of our forebears. The genealogy that's mentioned is a man named Peleg. And Peleg was, it says, in his days the earth was split. I believe the earth splitting there is talking about a total disruption of the social system with an administration of total confusion to the language that was there. But it was mentioned in two places. So the quiz question, of course, that you're just dying to ask is, well, when did Genesis 1 through 11 happen? I would take a wild guess here and say that it was at least creation happened about 150 generations ago. Most of us can't remember more than three or four or five generations at most, but about 150 generations ago, if I'm using a 40-year generation. One thing that I've been looking at, and I'm not sure as to the reality of it, unfortunately, now I've got some Bible scholars here. I don't know how long Adam and Eve were actually in a sinless state. May have been 100 years, may have been 200 years, may have been 300 years. I don't think it happened the day of creation. So there probably was some kind of time lapse from that to them actually sinning. There's a rule in Scripture called the rule of first mention, that when you first mention a thing, that typically will give a definition of that thing, whatever that thing is. So we got the number of days is mentioned, and in Hebrew, luckily for you guys, I don't speak Hebrew, but in the Hebrew, there's only one way to just nail it down as to what kind of day we're talking about. And you would say something like evening and morning were the first day, evening and morning were the second day, evening and morning were the third day. That's exactly how you would say it in Hebrew if you want to make people understand that we're talking about days, literal days. Now, because there was such a disruption in the earth as we know it, I believe, and you can see it in Noah's flood, I'll try and get to that a little later, but you can see that literally the length of the year changed, and it was a direct consequence to Noah's flood. Why is that important? Well, the length of the year, at least in Noah's flood, as you're reading the text, was 360 days. It wasn't a 365-day year. Was it that Noah was so dopey that he just couldn't count up to 365? No, it's because the length of days for an entire rotation around the sun was 360 days. The flood of Noah was so disruptive, though, that times really changed. There were actually 15 people groups in the world that would all count a 360-day year. Does anybody know how many degrees there are in a circle? 360. That actually came directly out of Babylon. But there, the Egyptians also were counting the year as 360 days. The calendar got so messed up from Noah's flood that we're still seeing the leftovers from all that. Let's see, what did we find? One other thing that I had mentioned in the past is that in Genesis, particularly 1 through 11, we're seeing paradise lost. We lost it. In the book of Revelation, which I think a lot of us are particularly interested in right now, we're seeing paradise found. We're also finding the tree of life here. So when I was a kid, I could only count one tree that was in the Garden of Eden. there were at least two that were of direct importance, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and also the tree of life. I just never got that in all my kids' stories. But I now realize in my dotage that the tree of life is kind of one of those important ones. And so also, rule of first mention, when was the first prophecy about Messiah? Everybody should know this. First prophecy about Messiah was Genesis 3. Hey, Chris. Good to see you. Chris, just wanted you to know, MacArthur Study Bible right here. All right. Genesis 3 is the very first mention of the seed of the woman. That is a picture of the one who is to come. That's this didn't take God by surprise. That's the other thing. One other thing that God can't do, he can't learn. Poor God can't learn because he knows everything. Yeah, so anyway, but anytime you're working with a circle, the 360 degrees, that's coming directly out of Babylon. The Egyptians also had the same thing. The Hebrews, of course, had the 360-day year. Why is that important? Because it has direct implication in regards to the timing of the prophecies. God uses this 360-day year as a prophetic marker. You'll find it in the book of Revelation, but the other crazy place that you'll find it is in Daniel's 70 weeks of years, when the prediction of the coming of the Messiah and his riding in on a donkey is predicted to the day. Jesus cried over Jerusalem when he was saying to them, if you had known this your day. Why did he say, if you had known this your day? Because that day was literally predicted about 600 years before, and the timer started. I can't remember, was it the building of the temple or the building of Jerusalem? I can never remember, but it's in a book called The Coming Prince by Sir Robert Anderson, who was the chief inspector for Scotland Yard. Anyway, it was something on the order of 188,880 days. And God, amazingly enough, got the day right when Jesus was to ride in on a donkey, but you needed to use a 360-day year. All of this stuff ties in. It's as if God actually knew the end from the beginning or something. You know, I just go, wait a minute, that ain't right. Also gives you a sense of the extraordinary power of Noah's flood. I've heard one estimate that said it was equivalent to 1 billion hydrogen bombs, which is... that makes for a bad day. That is how much energy was released in Noah's flood. So quiz question, where is the gospel first preached? This is top secret, so. Anybody know where the gospel is first preached? Genesis chapter 5 has the 10 antediluvian patriarchs. We're all related to them. It's Adam. Most of you remember Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared. Let's see, who was next? Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. So that's the 10 antediluvian patriarchs. Does anybody here speak Hebrew? Good, so I can say anything I want. That's great. So I just gave the Hebrew names of these guys, but if you translate those names, and that's the literal group of them, it's man is appointed mortal sorrow, the blessed God shall come down, teaching his death shall bring the despairing rest. And that's in Genesis 5. So there are, by the way, all kinds of codes, particularly numerical codes, in the book of Genesis and through the entire Bible. One thing that we don't see, because we're just not in that civilization, but the Hebrews had a number for every letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The same thing holds for the Greek. There are numerical characteristics that you wander all the way through the book of Genesis and all the other books of the Bible that are, it's almost like God knows numbers or something, or he's a mathematician. Go figure, you know? When Jesus said, not one jot or one tittle shall pass away, he was probably trying to tell us that not one jot or one tittle would pass away from God's word. You find crazy things. Has anybody here heard of DNA? So that's good. All right. That's an equal distance letter sequencing. That's how that code works out. It's ATCG. If you want to copy it down, then you'll know the code for DNA. If you take each letter and then put them together in triplicate or triple form, then you can code for every one of the amino acids. That's kind of, I'm thinking, maybe God designed DNA. You know, maybe he actually knew something about it. We find equal distant letter sequencings throughout the entire Bible. One of them that I just found fascinating was in Genesis 2, where it's actually talking about God creating the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, the great sea monsters, and everything else. Chapter 6 where he created man, on the sixth day where he created man, there are equal distance letter sequences in there that show just in chapter 2. It's not the characteristics of other chapters in the Bible, but right in there you find 25 different animals that are mentioned in equidistant letter sequences. You find 17 trees and plants that are found right in chapter 2. Like, I think God's just kind of putting some of his own graffiti there. He does put his fingerprints all over this. And we find these codes throughout the Bible. One other thing that's in particularly the first five books of the Bible are the equidistant letter sequences that, one equidistant letter sequence that starts in Genesis, and it also goes into Deuteronomy, but it points this way, right into Leviticus, is YHWH. And if you take that and do an equidistant letter sequencing from the first mention of the Y, first letter Y, and then go on from there, every eight letters, you get YHWH pointing this way. And then in Deuteronomy and also Numbers, you get YHWH pointing this way. It doesn't work in the book of Leviticus, but what you do find is that God is pointing to Torah, which is the name that God's given his word, the Torah. God is pointing to his word. Almost as if God knew about this stuff. You see these codes just kind of interweaving all over the place. Genesis chapter 10 is a unique piece of literature in that it gives all of the history of all of the peoples. These are our ever so ancient forebears, and we should all be able to, if we kept our family trees like we were probably supposed to, we could actually trace ourselves all the way back to the sons of Noah. Short story, but I'll make it long and arduous for you guys. I was talking to a woman one time. I was with Kaiser in Pasadena. I remember my horrible experience outside that church there. I was talking to a woman by the last name of Hastings. So she was telling me, oh yeah, my grandfather was a really great scholar. He went to the University of Edinburgh, looked up our family tree. I thought, this is fascinating. And she said, yeah, and our family tree goes way back. And I'm thinking, oh, that's nice. Nice family tree. I was supposed to see her son, but every once in a while I get on other topics, right? So she said, yeah, our family tree goes way back. I mean, it goes way, way, way back. I said, that's crazy. So how far back does it go? And she told me 1845. And I'm thinking, 1845, snort. And then she said B.C. And I'm looking, I think, so there bubbles over your head periodically. Say, oh, I'm in the presence of a crazy person. And that's with the bubble that you could have read over my head right then. You nod your head. It's like, you need to get out of here really fast. So I read a book called After the Flood, where Bill Cooper, any books by Bill Cooper, just way fun. He's the one that pulled out the books in the New Testament are actually found in Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Any of his books I can strongly recommend. But his book, After the Flood, he actually had, he had counted up five different lineages of peoples around the world that traced their lineages all the way back to the sons of Noah. Now that's something. Gloria and I have picked up two more, I think. Or maybe he didn't mention the Miao people in China. The Miao people can actually trace their lineages back to the sons of Noah. That's pretty impressive. Two royal lines in England can trace their lineages back. There's a royal line in Denmark. There's a royal line in Iceland. And there are a couple others that I can't remember. But anyway, I got this is about a year after I spoke with Mrs. Hastings, right? So I called her up and I said, hey, I've got this genealogy. I'd be interested if you can find any tie-ins with your family tree. She said, sure, send it all over. I'll be happy to look at it. So I called her up. I sent it to her. I called her up about 4 weeks later, and I asked her, so did you find any tie-ins with this family tree that I gave you? And she said, oh, no, I didn't find any tie-ins. I said, oh, bummer. She said, I just haven't had enough time. She said, okay, that's fine. So 2 weeks later, she called me back, and she said, well, you know, I did. I found four tie-ins with our family tree and the royal lines, one of the royal lines that you gave me. I thought, that is so fascinating. By the way, it goes to the sons of Japheth, in case you're curious. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japhetic lines, non-Semitic, but the royal lines in England go all the way back to the sons of Japheth. So she said, yeah, I found four tie-ins with our family tree. I thought, boy, that is just the best news. But she said, but, and you know, you hear but, it's like, oh, no, what am I going to hear now? She said, in some places, the family tree that you gave me was way off. I think, oh, no, is it just a, you know, it's a pile of punk crud. And she said, yeah, in some places, it's off by as much as 10 to 20 years. I'm like, oh, I am so disappointed. 10 to 20 years in the stage of history is like, I don't even care. So I actually know a lady whose family tree goes all the way back to Japheth, almost as if the Bible's really true. And that really kind of stems from the whole Genesis chapter 10. So the last chapter I'd kind of like to cover would be Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11 is the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel, so I want you guys to remember anything from Genesis 1 to 11, you should be actually able to find in secular histories or histories outside of the realm of Judaism, for example. In Genesis chapter 11, I'll tell you what I came to. I was reading, I better turn to it. We may as well look at the Bible today, right? Okay. Genesis chapter 11, verse 6. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another. And the Lord scattered them abroad and from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, the name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language from all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. So there's another rule of Bible interpretation. If it's said once, you can believe it. This is God speaking. If it's said twice, it's almost as if he's putting special emphasis on this. I want you guys to notice in that scripture reading, as we're reading, he says, we'll confuse him, we'll make it confused, and then we'll call it Babel. What does Babel mean? Confusion. That's three. So I read that, and I'm thinking, holy crud. there is something really different about the languages that we're being told about. It sure sounds like God confused the language. Gloria and I went to, can I use your name? Gloria and I went to a Japanese wedding in Pasadena. You have to be careful, right, when you're using names and
pay money.
I may have to do that later. So Gloria and I went to a Japanese wedding, and we heard about something called Japanese Hebrew cognates there. And so what's a cognate? Any ideas? Cognate is a word that's similar in one language as opposed to another. Example, evolution in English, evolucion in Spanish. Revolucion in Spanish, revolution in English. Do you guys hear? Oh, they're like the same. They're very similar. It's one of the reasons Spanish is fairly easy, because there are a lot of cognates in English to Spanish. Modern, moderna. Does anybody hear that? There's, hey, wait a minute. That sounds just like the same. It's a cognate, okay? So we had heard about Japanese, pardon? German also is going to have cognates. They're going to have lots of cognates. Anyway, so I heard Japanese Hebrew cognates. Well, try and tie this one together from an evolutionary standpoint. It's like, that makes no sense. Absolutely no sense. The couple was able to, and a couple weeks later, they gave us two books in Japanese by a Rabbi Marvin Tokayer. Don't read it, because unless you read Japanese. But so we were walking around. It's like, we're in Pasadena. You know, this is the highlight of intellectual endeavors. We should be able to find someone that can actually translate these two books for us. We never found anybody that could translate those two books for us. Then I found, so we kept those books for 2 years. We finally gave them back because they asked for them. We actually did finally give books back. That's unusual, too. You might just want to mark that. We did give some books back. So you know, it just always bothered me. It would have been so wonderful to find Japanese Hebrew cognates. But then we heard about a guy by the name of Isaac Moseson. He was a professor at the Yeshiva University in New York. And he had this crazy idea that all languages came from one primordial language, Biblical Hebrew. And he actually had a book. It was called The Word. And he had found, I think at latest number, we've got 24,000 Hebrew-English cognates, words that are very specific for one language that have kind of derived or gotten confused into another language. You guys don't realize this because we're speaking confused Hebrew right now, but there are huge numbers of words that are coming directly out of Hebrew that we wouldn't have guessed in. I actually emailed him and asked him about, yes?
If I may interject, one, and you can go to the website and go, biblical scholars and biblical archaeologists and stuff like this, there's never been really a language called Hebrew. It's actually Sumerian, Phoenician, and Canaanite.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. Yeah, because it ruins my story. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the other thing that you would find, so to go on with that, presently there are about 6,000 languages across the world, which is a lot of languages. Anyway, getting back to, where was I? Japanese. Oh, so Isaac Moseson had found 24,000 Hebrew-English cognates. I actually emailed him and I asked him, could you, have you ever heard of any Japanese Hebrew cognates? And so he sent me 11 pages of Japanese Hebrew cognates. I want you guys to think about that turn of events, because if you start finding cognates, that means that they have at least a common origin. In regards to the ancient languages, if you find the ancient language and you know how to speak it, you will also be finding cognates of that language going back to Hebrew, whether it's Sumerian or the all the other, the Babylonian languages. Every one of those languages, you will find is essentially confused Hebrew. There are Algonquin Indian words that are coming directly from Hebrew. The one link up that I vaguely recall is the word for skunk and stink. They actually come from the same Hebrew. Giraffe and scarf, having to do with the neck, they're actually coming from Hebrew. Anyway, I think it's I think that is kind of a hint that we're really dealing with a confused language as opposed to God creating brand new languages all over the place. The other person that actually agreed with me, I don't know if he's still alive, Noam Chomsky out of Harvard also believed that there was a primordial language. He would put the date way different than mine, but he was at least thinking that there had to be a primordial language. The Navajo Indians believe they called themselves the Diné, the people. They believe that there was a single primordial language, and then it got all confused. You will see these trends in ancient legends in the peoples that are around the world. By the way, the rules for understanding how languages change come from the Brothers Grimm. I'm related to the Brothers Grimm somehow. Maybe it's just through Adam, I'm not sure. But they did have languages in regards to how languages change out. One of those language chases, the only one I can actually remember is, I'm going to ask you a question. Let's see, that's spelled A-K-S, right? So that is actually one of the rules of the Brothers Grimm, where you see languages actually change or kind of evolve into something else. I don't know how much time do we have. Enough time for me to harass you some more. Genesis chapter 7 and 8 is talking about Noah's flood, I'm guessing. I didn't cover the, there's something very interesting to me in regards to Noah's flood. A couple things. One is, you know, how do you escape God's wrath? One is you can be taken out of God's wrath before it ever occurs. And there was one person who did that. His name was Enoch. Right. And the other way is to go into God's provision for our salvation called Noah's Ark. The Ark itself had one door. Jesus Christ called himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me, and I am the door. He is the door. There was only one door, and God had control over it. It was God that closed the door at the end when everything just went to water. By the way, Japanese pictographs, the word, the ancient word, and the reason you know it's an ancient word is because they were written on bone scribings. There were three picture languages in the world that I'm aware of. There may have been others. Chinese was one picture language. Hebrew was another, and so was the ancient Egyptian. But the picture that they had for the Chinese for a great boat had 8 mouths in it and a ship. Does everybody remember how many people were on Noah's Ark? It seems to be pointing back to Noah's Ark. So, and there are other things, particularly in regards to the Garden of Eden, that look like the Chinese knew all about Genesis 2, 3, 5, 6, and 7, and 8. The word for temptation, I don't remember exactly the words there, but I believe there's a garden, and I believe there's a snake and a tree in it. But you keep seeing these recurrent themes over and over again, almost as if it all came from the same common place. And what I would tell you guys is, of course it came from the same common place. I think that brings me to the very end. I think one thing that we can also glean from Genesis 1 through 11 is that God placed his judgment on an entire earth, and it's coming again. I believe God's judgment is coming again. And we, as rational human beings, need to take the door that God has provided for us. And the door's name is Jesus Christ.